Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Good evening. Welcome to the Birch Aquarium and to the Jeffrey B. Graham's Perspectives on Ocean Science Lecture Series. My name is Cheryl Peach, and I'm a program scientist here at the Birch Aquarium. And it's my great pleasure this evening to welcome Dr. Jules Jaffe. Jules is a research oceanographer here at the Marine Physical Lab at Scripps. And he came here over 20 years ago, right, Jules, from the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. And I was trying to think of how to sum up what Jules has done in one or two sentences. And I feel like really Jules has made his mark here as someone who's really a leader in developing innovative technologies to answer really, really challenging oceanographic questions. And so he's really been a leader in allowing us to understand some of the most complex systems within the oceans. And so it's really a pleasure to have him here this evening. And he's going to give us a glimpse into his vision for the future of ocean exploration in his talk titled Swarms of Small Autonomous Robots, a Future Vision for Ocean Observation. So welcome, Jules. Thank you very much for being here.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Actually, I gave a talk here about 10 years ago. I think I was the second speaker in this. I was the first speaker, yeah. So, you know, if you're into decadal oscillations, you can look at my talk from 10 years. Bad jokes, I know. It's too bad. The other thing I realized about that was you can see it on YouTube, that talk. And I've got 5-star rating. And so I'm actually doing better than most Chinese restaurants in San Diego. But I do want to welcome you here tonight and hope you enjoy this talk. I thought I'd talk about the future because I'm really excited about it, and we have some new ideas. And we haven't really accomplished many of the goals that I'm going to tell you about tonight. But it seems reasonable that a future generation of ocean technology would consist of miniaturized vehicles that had sensors that were inexpensive, that you could launch hundreds or even thousands of them. And, you know, next time you look at your cell phone, think of one with a housing around it that would go down and come back and tell you what it saw and tell you where it was with GPS. It seems logical to me that's going to be what, and I'll try to provide or hope to provide some of the scientific motivation for why I think that's a good idea. Okay, so Swarms of Small Autonomous Robots, a Future Vision for Ocean Observation. And thanks to Cheryl and Nigella. I always start these sort of public talks with a little bit about what we do in my group, partly because I like to tell people what I do, and hopefully you'll find it interesting. We work kind of at all different trophic levels. We're sort of engineers, technical sort of people who enjoy working with other scientists and being at a place like Scripps. It's been my pleasure to work with many of our scientists, Peter Franks, Mark Oman, we've done a little work with Ed Parnell, and these people are world leaders. And I have always believed that the teaming of people, technology people, and people that are more interested in the science and know the biology and the physics, perhaps, is a wonderful aspect of what I have the opportunity to do. So here we see sort of the different things that we do in my group, from microbes, phytoplankton, zooplankton, and fish. I don't really want to spend too much time on it, just to give you an idea of the things we do. In the microbial world, we're trying to develop a new kind of microscope that will allow us to see some of the smallest organisms that comprise maybe 90% of the biomass. With Peter Franks, we've worked on phytoplankton, developing imaging techniques for looking at small-scale phytoplankton distributions. Zooplankton, we've tracked hundreds of thousands, 1-millimeter animals with some colleagues in Israel, and working with Mark Oman here, we've worked on euphausids. And then also, more recently, we've been working in fish acoustics, trying to figure out how to use fisheries as a more advanced tool to not only see how many fish there are, but maybe how big they are and what kind of fish they are. One of the great highs you have in science is not just doing work, it's getting funded. And we recently got funded to do a wonderful project. And this is to learn about squid. Squid have this fascinating capability to change their reflectance. And we don't really quite understand the mechanism of how they do that. But me and a friend of mine here, Darius Stramsky, some researchers from other institutions, recently won a very large award from the Navy to actually study squid reflectance. And so as part of this, we decided to build a squid holodeck. So I don't know if you've ever seen the new Star Trek movie yet. It's actually pretty cool. But we want to put a squid in a synthetic environment. And here we have Mr. Spock, you know, saying, "Beam me up, Squiddy." Now, I don't know why when we submitted this proposal, my colleagues decided to take this part out. But we got funded anyway, and so you can still have some fun in this business. So we're really looking forward to that. Okay, so let me tell you what you really came here to hear, and what I came to tell you about was to talk about how we use... The idea of our group is that we're not necessarily interested in... We enjoy working with scientists, but I enjoy the development of technology. And I was trying to think of some kind of analogy that I could make with people that had a more common experience. And so as our planet sort of is in more and more trouble, we want to understand what's going on. And that means that we need to develop technology or even utilize current technology to understand what's happening with the planet. And so I thought of ourselves more like planetary radiologists. So if you have a problem, you go get an MRI or you go get a CT scan. Somebody might do an ultrasound. So our group really is in the process of developing technology to really try to understand, you know, how ecosystems are evolving, maybe how animals use various opportunities to change their cells and optimize their quest for survival. Okay, so that was an analogy there. So I wanted to try to place what we're doing in the context of current oceanography, partly to have you understand the differences, but the other part, of course, is to make sure that people don't think we think we're doing something that nobody ever did before and it's going to solve all the problems. I've never said that. And so every time I give a talk like this, I always learn something. And so here's a sort of spectrum of tools that oceanographers are using today. So we have current tools for understanding the ocean. If you look here, you'll see this cabled observatory that the people at the Monterey Bay Research Institute are building, this MARS cabled observatory. And this whole idea was really started by a bunch of geologists who decided it would be great to have a 24/7 presence on the seafloor, and no one doubts that. And it's actually morphed into doing more biology, which is wonderful as well, because we can put all kinds of things on these cabled observatories. We can see them in real time, and we can develop all kinds of wonderful sensors. Most of the things we're more familiar with would be here, say a ship that actually tows something. Here you see a two-dimensional picture of perhaps velocity or phytoplankton. We have moorings, we have gliders, we have floats, we have, let's see, satellites. We have, what else do we have? Autonomous underwater vehicles, okay? And these are all the sort of tools that people have developed over the last 50 years. And some of these are good at doing some things, and some of these are not so good at doing other things. And I want to show you a vision of tools that I think fills a very interesting niche in the realm of oceanographic systems, because I'm going to claim that no other systems can get the kind of data that we're proposing to get. And also, the foundation for that claim, of course, is that it's important to know these things. And I hope to convince you of that by the end of this 40 minutes. Okay, so I want to give you a little bit of an education on what we're doing. And it turns out that there's a kind of reference frame that I want to sort of get you into, which is called the Lagrangian reference frame. And it's fairly easy to explain what that means. And I use this analogy from driving a car. And so imagine you're sitting on the highway. You just walked over here to the 5 or down to the shores. And you sat there at one place, X naught. That's just one place. And time was continuous. So you're just hanging out, and you're watching cars go past. And you make a chart. You make a chart of how fast the cars are going as a function of time. So one guy passes at 1 minute and he goes 25 miles an hour. Another one passes 30 seconds later and he goes 30 miles an hour. And you graph those times. Well, that's called an Eulerian point of view. That's what a mooring does. You put a mooring in the ocean. Maybe you put some current meters on it. It's at one place. It has continuous time. And it's mapping velocity. It may do that in a depth point of view. Now imagine that instead of sitting at one place, you're actually traveling with the flow. And in this coordinate system, what I want you to simply think of is maybe driving along the highway. So instead of sitting at one place at one time, you're actually sitting in a car, and maybe you're sitting with me in a car, and as I'm driving along, hopefully not breaking any laws and speed limits, you can actually write down what my velocity is. So I slow down when I want to change lanes, and I'll stop when there's a red light. And that's called the Lagrangian point of view. And I know that's a little hard to see. I apologize for that. But that's actually moving along with the flow. So you're actually changing your location, because when you're sitting in a car with me, you're going to change where you are. And you're going to map velocity as a function of time. So here I am, driving along in my car. Whoops, there we go. Off to be in a Lagrangian coordinate system. Okay, so I hope that's kind of clear. Just sit with me and we'll drive around and you can figure out how fast I'm going. And that's the idea of these floats. Okay, so now I always get into trouble when I give these talks because I often don't accentuate how much wonderful work other people have done. And so there are other people that do the same thing. And the Lagrangian point of view actually is about, the point of view is probably older than people that have built instruments to make Lagrangian measurements. And so we're talking now about a float, something you put in the water, and it actually sort of goes with the flow, and it floats around. Maybe it has sensors on it. Maybe you can track it in three dimensions. And these actually started back in the 1950s with a fellow named Swallow from the UK. I love this picture. They had the cat on the boat, you can see here. And he figured out if you took an aluminum tube that was something like, 2.5 meters long, you could actually ballast it. That means put weights on it so it would become neutrally buoyant at an interesting depth. And he had a transmitter in here, and they had an acoustic signal that this thing sent out. It would bleep every minute or seconds or something like that. And they had a bunch of hydrophones or underwater microphones on the boat, and they could listen to this thing. And it was really the first picture they started to get of the energetics of the ocean. Up to this time, people didn't really understand how energetic the interior of the ocean could be. And this fellow, John Swallow, really kind of was the pioneer of all of that. And now let's fast forward a little bit. A very famous scientist, like Tom Rossby at University of Rhode Island, has been building Lagrangian floats now for maybe 30 years or 40 years. And he's very, very excited about the opportunity, the kinds of information these systems can get. Because you might imagine if you had enough of these floats, they would follow the currents in ways that you wouldn't know if you were sitting at one place at one time measuring velocity. And I'm not saying that's the wrong thing to do. I'm just saying it's a different kind of measurement. And then most recently, one of my colleagues, Eric DeSaro at the University of Washington, has been building these floats, these mixed layer floats. And these guys are pretty much the world's expert on these. So I'm sort of pre-adolescent in the float world, but hoping to rise to the ranks of people who know how to do these things really well. And of course, being at Scripps isn't a bad place to be, because right across the parking lot from me is Russ Davis, who's been working on Lagrangian technology now for 30, 40 years. Very, very good physical oceanographer who's written some wonderful articles on how you even interpret these data to get currents out. And you may be familiar with the Argo program and the ALICE floats and the P-ALICE floats that Russ has developed over the world. So the oceanographic technology cup of sugar is when we have problems, one of my engineers wanders across the parking lot and talks to one of Russ's guys, and it's all of a sudden it works, and it's the really great thing about being at a place like Scripps. So, a little bit of the evolution of Lagrangian floats in my group. I want to give you a feeling for my perspective on why I even got into this business. And this is an example of one of the first things we built, which is an instrument for looking at phytoplankton with a multi-beam sonar. So this sends sounds out, and we bounce them off animals. And if we're good enough, we can see the animal when it's far enough away so that it doesn't know we're there. And then we all of a sudden learned that we had no idea what we were looking at. And one of the wonderful things about our business is we can learn something that we need to know, and if we make a good enough pitch, we can convince somebody to fund us to figure it out. It wouldn't work in a lot of other worlds. So we actually put this strobe light and a camera here, and we were able to take pictures of the animals and also of phytoplankton using a laser sheet. And one of the things we noticed was that if we put this over the side and the ship was bouncing up and down, everything in the water looked blurry. once in a while we got, it's sort of obvious, but once in a while we got an image where the ship was just at the bottom of its heave or at the top of its heave, and we thought, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure this out, but maybe what we should do is have a vehicle that's a free fall vehicle that would actually be thrown off the ship and it would have a free descent. And what we mean by that, now we get away from the moving coordinate system of being on the surface. We throw it off. It descends very, very slowly, taking pictures of the animals either with sound or at light. And this is our free fall imaging vehicle, the Phyto vehicle here. And what you see here, these are floats at the top. If you're a sailor, what you want is your center of gravity to be very low so your boat doesn't tip over. So our center of buoyancy is very high. These are floats. And this thing basically goes into the water, descending very, very slowly, taking pictures. And this is my example. This is a 3D animation that I did a few years ago, which kind of embodies the flavor of this thing, slowly descending into the water column. That's a laser sheet that's looking at phytoplankton. So now we're decoupled from the ship heave. We're slowly going down, and we can take our utilization of the images went up to 90%. We'd no longer have to worry about the boat bouncing up and down on the surface and getting all these blurry pictures. So next thing we did, and here's a couple of examples of pictures that we got with this system, very exciting to us. And so one of the big highs of what I do is measuring something that no one had ever seen before. And this sort of aha experience that accompanies our work, you work so hard, you get the idea, you write the proposal, usually it doesn't get funded the first time, you rewrite the proposal, you build the instrument, you take it out to sea, you get the pictures, you process the data, and then aha, there they are. These are Pseudonychia diatom chains that are longer than anyone had ever seen before. And the reason we think they're longer than anyone had ever seen before, these are on the order of maybe 4 or 5 centimeters, is because the technology involved in capturing these, typically, you open a bottle and stuff rushes in, disrupts the fragile stickiness of these things. So these are little guys that grow by reproducing, and they sort of stick to each other. And so I remain fascinated with this sort of microscopic world and the forces that hold things together and how we disturb them in our process of observation. And here's an example of how we saw something that no one had ever seen because we more or less did it in an undisturbed fashion. And the other thing that people have known for a long time is that this is now a fluorescence image. What we do is we shine a blue light in and red light comes out of the chlorophyll, just like that's in all the trees that you see around here. And that gives us an idea for how many phytoplankton there are. And you see this gradient of phytoplankton is quite strong. And that is, it was an exciting thing for us. This here is depth in centimeters. So over maybe 8 or 10 centimeters, we're seeing very, very strong gradients. Well, this is a story that I need to keep moving on because those aren't really the messages I want to give you. The next thing we decided was, well, we'd really like to control how slowly we were or quickly we were descending. So we thought, well, why don't we put some pistons on there? And if you remember the Archimedean principle, you will remember that your buoyancy controls how fast you sink or float. So if you're in a swimming pool and you exhale, usually you go down a little bit. So this is the same thing. These guys are inhaling and exhaling, and they allow us to change the volume of this system, and they allow it to change its density, and therefore it floats. I mean, it sinks or it floats. And it's pretty amazing that this huge thing doesn't have to change its density very much in order for us to change its speed. And that way we were able to even further control the kinds of images we got. The last system I want to show you here is our last system that we built on this was actually a three-dimensional optical system for getting information about velocities. And it was a nice process on the ship. One of our close colleagues from Stanford, a professor there, Steve Monismith, who studies currents and things like that. And as the crews evolved, he just kept putting more and more instruments on this thing because he became sort of a Lagrangian convert. He was really excited about the possibilities for seeing things in this Lagrangian context. And this is one of the images that we got of a velocity field. So that's how we sort of got into these big, big vehicles that could be Lagrangian. In other words, the same, like, remember me and you were driving along the highway in my beautiful truck, and you're basically writing down the velocity as a function of time, but you're with me. So now we decided, actually this sort of evolved. I went to a meeting about 8 years ago. A couple of friends of mine, now friends of mine, Simon Levin, who's a professor at Princeton, a mathematical ecologist, invited me to a meeting. And the woman who's now the head of NOAA, Jane Lubchenco, was there. And they basically said, Jules, we want you to help us figure out how we can learn about larvae, fish larvae, other kinds of larvae, and how they're pushed around by currents. And I thought it would be a fun thing to work on. So we started to develop small floats that could actually change their ballast or change their density, that perhaps we could track them in three dimensions. And that way, judge where currents were going, because of course from the animal's point of view, it is in the Lagrangian framework. And so our first one was this. It really looks like a tin can, and we found out that it just didn't have enough buoyancy change to be able to do that. So we built this other one, which I thought, you know, I'm a sort of frustrated artist in a way. I thought, well, let's make something that has some sculptural kind of quality to it, you know. And if you know sculpture, you may be aware of Brancusi, who is one of my most favorite sculptors of all time. And so I thought, well, let's make a Brancusi-esque oceanographic instrument. So we made this sort of silver ball. And actually, it worked. And this is our current incarnation of it. It actually has a piston down here. I think the next illustration. Okay, so we're going to talk about that more in a little while. And the other theme that I want to try to sort of highlight tonight is what I see as an interaction between science and management and education. And I must say, when I was a lot younger, people would show these kind of slides, and I would like think, the guy doesn't have anything to talk about. So, you know, it kind of comes around on you. You know, that's the process of but I really think it's important. And that's why I'm showing it to you. And I want to show you that these goals are interwoven in what we do. And we've pretty much been working in this area here, we being the scientists. And I want to show you why management is interested in what we're doing. That is, people who manage ecological systems and ecological resources, and how I think we can get kids excited about science. Because you may be aware that there is a problem now in that a lot of younger kids, middle school kids, high school kids, are not really electing careers in technology and science. And I think we can form a sort of web of connectivity here, which will allow us to transfer to them the exciting aspects of what we do, which is a lot of what you don't get when you're in middle school or in high school, and to transfer to these guys, hopefully, you know, our planetary radiologists will be able to tell people that are thinking about doing ecosystem therapy how to do it, not how to do it, but what's going on, so they can make more informed decisions. Okay, so I wanted to now talk about the scientific motivation for building these Lagrangian floats. So we're going to try to build small floats, and we're going to show you why they might be useful. Well, the first thing you might want to do is just track a water parcel. So imagine now you're on a boat, or you're in a submarine, or you're snorkeling, and you think there's a cubic meter of water out there that for some reason you're really interested in. Now, why you would be interested in that, there's lots of reasons. There's a lot of stuff going on. There's a million bacteria in every milliliter of water. There's 30,000 phytoplankton cells in every milliliter of water. There are the density of zooplankton, small copepods in the oceans are about 1 per cubic meter. But of course, we know at night a lot of those guys are coming up, and their density are quite high. So just imagine now you wanted to track a water parcel because you wanted to look at the time evolution of that water parcel as it was exposed to sunlight and nutrients, as zooplankton came and predated on phytoplankton. And how would you do that? Well, one way you might do it is by using a float like our float. This is the float that we now have operational in our lab. And one way you might be able to track that is by sending sound waves out of a ship, just like John Swallow did in 1951, and being able to communicate with this float and tell where it is. And that way you could actually track a water parcel. And other people have tried to track water parcels. It's pretty easy to put a float out on the ocean, something that actually sits on the surface and has something below called a drogue, which is sitting at some depth, and that drogue is pushed along by the current. And so what you're doing is you have a depth drogue. And you might think, well, that's really easy. That water parcel is just going to go horizontally in the ocean, so I'll just build a depth drogue, and then I can tell what the ocean is doing. Well, it turns out life is more complicated than that. So the kinds of things you might want to do are net tows, water samples, in situ studies. There are these waves in the ocean called internal waves. And it's, you know, the only time you ever really might see an internal wave is when you look at the surface of the water and you'll see these bands of slick and rough water. And these turns, sometimes they're associated with internal waves. But now just think of a density difference. So think about, you know, oil sitting on water, okay? And oil floats on water. And if you push, there's an interface there, the oil and the water. If you push that interface, it's going to oscillate with a certain frequency. Oddly enough, it does. And these waves actually propagate along these density differences. And here you see an animation of how that works. I'll try to run that again. So here you see these little yellow dots here, I hope you can see them, are actually staying on the interface. And so if you had a water parcel that you were trying to track by keeping something at one depth, you wouldn't be able to track it because it's going up and down, as you would see from these internal wave fields. And so a good friend of mine, a colleague who works in Israel, told me of an experiment they had done last summer where all they had was a depth drogue, and these internal waves were pushing things up and down to the point where they made life very difficult for them. So here we have our float, and you're able to track it up and down because it's going to be like one of these little yellow dots going up and down with the water, and it'll even tell you where it is. You can localize it. You can even communicate with it. So maybe we just want to put a tracer in the water, and we want to use it as a sampling protocol. But that's not swarms of vehicles, you're probably thinking, and we'll get to that in a little while. So what do we need? We need an intelligent drifter that has two-way communication that can be tracked in 3D. And we just happen to have a couple of these in our lab. That was that Brancusi-esque sculpture that I showed you. And here you see there's a modem here that actually allows us to acoustically communicate with this. It has a buoyancy control, has a microprocessor. This is a satellite link. This thing, in principle, will come to the surface and tell us where it is. Although that's been a little harder than we've anticipated, it certainly can adjust its buoyancy, and this is what I call our AUE vehicle. And we can actually talk to these things over a kilometer or so. And it's about, you know, a little more than a half mile, which isn't bad. We would love to be able to talk over longer distances, and we could do that with lower frequencies and perhaps a little more power. But if you really wanted to follow something around in a boat for a week or so, this would be a good option. Now let's go to something called larval dispersal, which was really the first motivation for building these things. And now we need more than just one of them, but let me tell you a little bit about the life history of some of the organisms in the ocean. And here you have a sea urchin, purple sea urchin, and this slide was provided by Alyssa Montaldo, who's a SIO student. And here you see this, after fertilization, we go through this stage of a unicell and then division, and they form these little crazy-looking things. But what I want to emphasize, 2 points. The size range here, these guys are around 50 microns. So your human hair is about 100 microns. So it's about half the thickness of a human hair. Little tiny guys. And these guys get to be about a millimeter in size when they get a bit bigger. So that's one of the things. And the other thing that I should tell you that's not on this slide is after these are born, they actually have a phase where they go out into the ocean. We call it a pelagic phase. Pelagia meaning the sort of oceanic phase of these things. So even organisms that actually settle, these little sea urchins, as you know, settle in these coastal areas, they actually go through this pelagic stage. And it's really not quite understood how a little guy that's a millimeter or 50 microns can go and be out in the ocean for a month or two and make it back to shore, because they're really being pushed around by currents at this point. So we think that their behavior is perhaps less important than the currents that push them around. And the way to study these currents, we believe, is using these floats. So here's one theory about what happens. And so if you fly a lot in elevators, you know they have those moving sidewalks. So imagine a moving sidewalk that's actually vertical. So you have one at this level and one at the next level, and they're actually moving in different directions. So the first thing you do when you're a little baby, you hitch a ride on one of these currents, and it takes you out to sea. And then as you get bigger, maybe you increase your lipid content, nothing personal, I might add, and then you hitch a ride coming back on another current that maybe is higher up in the water. So we think that their ability to control their buoyancy as they age actually plays an important part in how they regulate where they're transported. Because for the most part, these guys have a hard time swimming. Okay, now we think, as I've said, circulation patterns play an important role in larval dispersal. And so the idea is here that this graph shows how far they can go with the water pushing them around. And this curve, shows how far they can go from swimming. And as you see, the major force in their life, especially when they're little teeny 50-micron guys, you might imagine, can't swim very far. And the problem, of course, is that overfishing reduces the number of fish and lowers their sort of saturation of the ecosystem. And this is just to show that when we want to think about repopulating areas, what we'd like to do is have a whole colony here, and maybe some of the larvae are pushed around by the water, and then they start over. They can settle here, and then they're pushed around by the water, and then they can settle here. And if you start taking out these regions now where the fish cannot reproduce, your pattern of larval dispersal changes. And so there's widespread belief that if we understood coastal circulation better in terms of the vertical differences in it and the seasonality in it, that we could understand this dispersal of larvae, which would allow us to do a little bit of a better job on these marine protected areas. And we'll get a little bit more. I'm sort of jumping ahead of myself, but I wanted to tie that in now. So what do we need now? Well, we need swarms of underwater floats. I mean, you knew we were going to get to that at a certain point. And so here's one of them. I actually brought one with me. This is a model that we have. Not really a model. This one actually works. It's this big. And this was made by a bunch of very smart mechanical engineering students up in UCSD. We have a good relationship with Professor Colophone. And this thing doesn't do a lot, but it does something interesting. And it can adjust its buoyancy. It can measure temperature. It can measure depth. And it's small. It's about a liter in size. And it's actually not very expensive. These things we think can be made for on the order of $500 or so. A newer model that the students have been working on is over here. I'm not sure how easily you guys can see these. I apologize if that is a problem. This one here, and actually shows, this is actually a little compressed air cylinder that people who bicycle ride, who don't want to be pumping, myself not included in that group, use. And so it's actually using the compressed air to blow up a little bladder and reduce it, and that allows it to go up and down in the water column. So these things are not necessarily that complicated to build, and we believe that if a bunch of smart senior mechanical engineers can believe these, I'm going to try to convince you that a couple of middle school kids might even be able to put a kit together someday. And we'll talk about that in a little while. So it needs to adjust its buoyancy, and it has to be tracked in three dimensions. So this is the one I just showed you, and that's another design for it. Okay, now people, we're not the first people to think about doing Lagrangian studies. And here's some studies that people have done in the coastal regions here. These are actually further out, and you see these loops that from eddies. I just wanted to give you a feeling for what the data might look when you actually put a bunch of these guys in. And so we're tracking them. Here we show a two-dimensional path, but in fact we're equally interested in the three-dimensional behavior of these. And we'd want ours to be closer and sure, and we'd also want them to have some mimic of the behavior of larvae. So this is a study that was done a little more than 10 years ago. Okay, so now I'm going to talk a little bit about harmful algal blooms as a third example of what we might do with these guys. So as you know, harmful algal blooms are a big problem in many, many areas. And this is one of the toxic phytoplankton, Carinia brevis, that is here. You can see a bloom of this stuff. And I was excited because our Pseudonychia friends, perhaps a different exact kind of Pseudonychia, the same image that we saw before with those long chains, actually do produce toxins under certain circumstances. And I'm not sure, it's certainly not clear to me, and I also believe it's not exactly clear to the phytoplankton ecologists when these guys will start to produce toxins. But we could imagine if we wanted to track a bloom, we could actually put a bunch of our floats there. Now, one of the luxuries of preparing a talk is that you just go grab a circle from the library of shapes and you pull a little arrow on it. And hey, that's easier than spending 8 years writing proposals and building things. So I'm not naive enough to think that this is going to be easy. But it's a kind of dream. And I just wanted to tell you one other thing that we're working on, a really exciting development. About 3 months ago, I went to a talk here at UCSD. And met with and heard a talk where this, I can't say his first name, I won't try, Professor Yang from Caltech, showed us a microscope on a chip. So here's a quarter, And basically, this is a whole new kind of microscope. It's really, really amazing. It's a microfluidic chamber with a light above it and a lot of little holes below it. And as particles flow through this microfluidic chamber, he's actually able to create images of those particles. And he can get 100 of these chambers on a chip that's this size. And so our little drogues floats would be the perfect place to put one of these. And so when I went to him up after the talk, you really never know how people can react. He said, "Oh, I've been looking for an oceanographer to work with because I'm really excited about these things." And I said, "Great, we're your guy." You know, so this is the kind of stuff I think you're going to be seeing coming out. And hopefully 100 of these little microscopes would allow us to put, 100 of these on one little chip would allow us to start to actually not just see if they're fluorescing, but maybe we can actually image what they are. And he's shown some very impressive images of how this thing will work. So there's a whole other world of sensor technology. Briefly, management issues. The big buzzword today is ecosystem-based management. We want to know what the ecosystem is doing, and then we can start to talk about how we're going to modulate, restrict, affect maybe fisheries, harvesting. Under the impression, look, I understand there's a lot of people that rely on these things to make a living and very sympathetic to all of those needs. It's not anybody, there's, what we need is information. I mean, the fundamental premise of being a scientist is you need information. So here we are again, our planetary radiologists trying to figure out, do we need to put in a stent or a heart transplant? And so in order to do eco-based management, we need to think about what is the ecosystem doing? And it's a little sort of sad. I mean, it's not a little sad. It's actually a lot sad that in my estimation, we don't have a lot of tools. We've been working with the state on these marine protected areas. And it's pretty scary because they're setting them aside now and they don't really have the way to monitor them. And there's going to be a lot of pressure on these people to reopen these and to actually validate whether they're working or not. And so where do we put them, how well are they working, and how to improve them in the case of marine protected areas? So I'm not suggesting that our swarms of floats are going to solve all of the problems in ecosystem-based management or the establishment of marine protected areas. Of course, what you do is you get your blood work up, and then you get your ultrasound, and you put it all together, and you try to make a decision about what the status is and how we're going to affect change and monitor change. Okay, so this is again on larval dispersal. Decreasing animal populations has led to the establishment of these marine protected area, and if they're connected enough, we want to be able to choose them so that an animal will be able to, the adults can grow and prosper here, and their babies can make it there, because if that's too far, we'll never be able to repopulate these areas. The prevailing currents in some of these areas are actually southward, as you know. But they're also big eddies. And of course, I was on the New York Times website today looking at the search for Flight 447, this awful tragedy that occurred a few weeks ago. And I thought to myself, they're now looking for a black box. The black box puts out a signal at 30 kilohertz, which you could hear from 2 kilometers away. 2 kilometers away is more than a mile. And now you think to yourself, the ocean is 6 kilometers deep there, I think. Imagine a swarm of these floats that we could even just throw off a plane that could slowly descend, listening for that 30 kilohertz tone, come back to the surface, and tell us where that is. It has to be a good idea that they're autonomous, inexpensive manned exploration, both for many, many purposes. It just has to be something that is going to happen. And I also want to talk about education. And I'm a little more fascinated with informal education because, as an adult, I love browsing around on the web and reading all kinds of different crazy things, quantum teleportation and all kinds of stuff. But really, the need is to get kids excited about science. And I think we can do that. And in order to do that, it has to be participatory. They want to be doing something. Sitting a kid in a classroom and teaching him what people found out 50 years ago, even though it's exciting and important, is not what these kids are looking. Think of the amount of bandwidth. I used to watch TV and do my homework. My kid would would watch TV, be on instant messenger, he's texting with his friends, and he's doing his homework. So it's a different world now. They're used to a lot more sensory input. And that doesn't mean we need to dumb things down. I'm not suggesting that. We have to smarten things up and make it so there's enough information to keep them engaged. And of course, they want things that are goal-oriented. So there's a reason why they're doing this. And hey, if it was even meaningful, all the much better. And we're going to get back to that as part of my vision. So what do we want in a vehicle? We'd like it small. We'd like to be observable in 3D. We want it to be adaptive. The moorings are wonderful, but if you're a fisherman, what you want to do is go where the fronts are. That's where the upwellings are. That's where the nutrients are. That's where some of the small animals that the bigger animals eat are. And these mobile platforms, such as gliders, such as floats, ships as well, which we've been using for a long time, I'm not suggesting mine is the only mobile platform, are perfectly suited to be more adapted. And of course, if we're going to have thousands of them out there, they better be inexpensive. So there's lots of technology here. I'm not going to go through all of it. We'd like them to be ballasting. We want them to be networkable. We'd hope they could be networkable. In other words, they can talk to each other. And why do we want that? Because maybe a few of them would drift so far away that I'd have to send a really loud sound so that they could hear it and send a really loud sound back to me. But if they actually could send the sound just maybe a tenth of that, and a tenth of that, and a tenth of that, if you work out the energetics of that, since radiation spreads quadratically, if you actually divide those distances by a tenfold difference, it actually pays off real big. So a lot of these little guys will be much more efficient in talking around. It's like when my mom wanted me to come up, at 5 o'clock to have dinner, and I was, maybe 100 meters away, she had to scream really, really loud. If I had five friends in between, hey, tell Jules, his mother is calling him. His mother is calling him. Go upstairs and have dinner. It's the same thing. And we want them to have lots of wonderful sensors. And this is an area that's seen a lot of development in the last 10 years. There's a number of oceanographic programs that are developing sensors. And we need them to be globally referenced. So here's the thing I've already shown you. This is the two, the AUE and the mini AUE that are in our lab. This guy's pretty operational. These guys were just sort of having fun with writing proposals, although that's not much fun, but making the things and then trying to inform people on what a good idea. Well, we can control them, so we can talk to the mechanical engineers and we can say, hey, I'd like that guy to go to 30 meters for 10 minutes. And we can have him go to 30 meters for 10 minutes. And here's the smaller guy in one of our tanks going to a depth for a certain amount of time as well. So we want them controllable. We want them to be able to talk to each other. So we put one of these on a mooring, and one of them was a kilometer away, and the other one said, hey, I want you to go up and down, and you kind of have to trust me that this is the graph of what the other one did. It did what we told it to do. Nothing up these sleeves. And so what about position? Because really, we want to know where they are in 3D. Just if you were in my car with me, you'd want me to have my GPS on probably so you could see where we were. And then you could tell what the traffic patterns in San Diego County were. So we could actually have them just listening to something transmitting on the surface. Or we could have them talking to each other. And there's also another fascinating idea here to use ambient sound. And it turns out that there's a lot of noise in the ocean. And that noise is often due to waves maybe 50 or 100 kilometers away. And so imagine now a sound wave hitting one of these guys first and then traveling to hit this one. And these guys have the ability to remember when that sound wave hit them. And we can compare those two times and, in principle, tell the difference, the distance between these two. It's a lot more complicated than that. So if your mind is thinking, gee, that seems like an oversimplification, you're right. But I don't have enough time to tell you how it's really going to work. Okay. Now, this is an example of being kind of silly but actually getting funded. So my colleague, Kurt Schergers, put these Death Stars in our proposal. So these are the Death Stars from the Star Wars. And actually, I looked at this proposal after it was funded, and I said, Kurt, you put the Death Stars in the proposal. He said, yeah, I know. I said, and we got funded. He said, yeah, amazing, wasn't it? But I said, yeah, okay, either they're stupid or they have a sense of humor. Either way, I don't care. But here we have the Death Stars, and they're communicating to a surface drifter here, and they're actually able to obtain their three-dimensional position. Okay, so what are we doing now? Well, we're doing hardware development. We need a little more buoyancy out of this guy. We need a deeper mini AUE. And we'd like to make them inexpensive. We're working with wonderful mathematicians in the electrical engineering department here, and mechanical engineering, who are helping us to figure out how they can talk to each other, how we control them, and I've written 3 proposals in the last 4 months. But that's what you do. That's what our business is. Now let's get back to what I was warning you I would talk to you about, science education and management here. And this is sort of the final slide or two. So if you didn't have enough cheese and crackers, there are still some out there. But a vision for future development soon. So I just have this idea in my head. I mean, I think what you have to kind of do is think about this sort of platonic vision of where you want this thing to go, and then you make little steps in that direction. And that's what it is. And I'm talking to you tonight because I enjoy this community, and I think it's good for us scientists to get out and tell people what we're up to. Some of my colleagues are here in marine technology who thought it would be interesting to come. In a week and a half, I'm going to NOAA, and I'm going to talk at a brown bag lunch about the same ideas, because I'm really trying to get NOAA into funding a program like this. And if I don't get the money, that would be the next best thing that could happen, because I really think we should be doing it. And so imagine now the California coast, here's Santa Barbara, the Channel Islands, and just looking at swarms of hundreds of these, maybe even thousands of these things, as they get transported down the coast. And what does that do for us? Well, I've tried to convince you from a scientific point of view, we can learn a lot about coastal dynamics and circulation. And I showed you 3 examples: water parcel tracking, larval dispersal, and the third one is perhaps if we had good enough sensors to track harmful algal blooms. And then from a management point of view, I've made the point, and I hope you trust me enough to believe, that selection of marine protected areas is an important aspect of preserving the coastal ecosystem. And in terms of understanding the circulation, we would like to know the circulation better. And this was told to me by some people that really do know why this is important. And so the final vision I have is one of education. And to me, in a way, this is as exciting as the other two. And now what I did here was I dodged a photo. So through the magic of computer science, I took a picture of a kid sitting at a computer. But I was at an NSF meeting in February, which is supporting at a very nice level the involvement of scientists in middle schools, in high schools, even in undergraduate programs. And so the idea that I'm going to tell them about next year, I'm going to write them a proposal, is to actually have these kids building these floats. I mean, I think that if a group of smart undergraduates could build one of these from scratch, a group of smart high school or middle school kids could build one of these in a kit. And we've gotten some good feedback from NSF on that. And what do they learn about this? Well, it's goal-oriented. There's a sense of ownership because it's their float. And so we'll teach them electronics. We'll teach them physics. We'll teach them about satellites. We'll teach them about ecology, marine protected areas. We'll teach them about coastal circulation. And we'll teach them about computers using Google Earth. And here you see this kid who I imagine sitting at the computer looking at his float, the one that he built that we launched into the California Current, to track it and feel like some feeling of ownership and to learn all about those things. So that's all I wanted to tell you about today. And I hope you find these ideas as exciting as I do. So thank you very much for your time. The question was, do we have a plan for picking them up when we're finished with them? And so we've got to be pretty green, right? Because we don't want to be throwing stuff in the ocean. So my plan is we offer $100 for every one they get. And we're going to give them the GPS coordinates. And we're going to tell them, look, if you get these to me before I'm finished using them, I'm not going to pay it. And I have a feeling you would get a lot of them back. I mean, it's a pretty good deal, you know. And for us, if they're $500 a piece, another $100 just to get it back and refurbish, it is probably not a bad idea. So in principle, whatever ones we can continue to track, which I'm hoping are most of them, I think there's an opportunity there. It might be a crazy idea, but that, you know, we'll offer a reward and tell them where it is. I have a feeling if you went out in a day, you'd probably make $500, $1,000 in a 5-mile radius or something like that. Anyone else? Yes, ma'am. Okay, the question was, what if an animal eats it? I don't want to be superfluous, so I'm going to answer your question. I think it would be unfortunate. And the question is whether, you know, these are hard questions about what your risk is and what your perception of what you can learn. And I would, you know, I think there's a possibility. I don't know these would be very attractive to animals. I mean, I'm not trying to be condescending or flip, but I don't know. I think there is, of course, an unintended consequence that an animal might ingest one of these things. I think it would be unfortunate, and I hope that it doesn't happen, and I hope that we have so much to learn from them that it makes sense. I mean, honestly, there are so many things. I'm not saying we should contribute to the amount of bad stuff that's out there. That's never a stance that anyone should make. But I would imagine that it wouldn't be as visible, maybe. You know, even 1,000 of these things might not be so visible, too. But it's a good question. We don't want to be polluting the ecosystem. We don't want to be creating harm. I don't know why they would. I think a lot of animals have sensors that sense chemicals, sense motion, turbulence. Hopefully these things will not have be attractive to these animals. But I understand your concern, and I sympathize with it. We certainly don't want that to happen. Yes? Okay, so the question, this is always a good question, how far do the larvae go when they swim out to sea, and how do they know when to come back? So I imagine they go out tens of miles, actually, or even, I don't know exactly. People, you can do net tows out there and find larvae. It depends which kind of animals they are. And how they know to come back, there's a question about whether they're opportunistic. So imagine, you know, you have 10,000 babies. I mean, I'm putting my kids through college right now. I can't think about that, 10,000 of them. But there's a hint that the ecosystem sort of optimizes itself so that, you know, just the way the grunions are coming tonight, I guess the grunions are coming, there are timing in the ecosystem that will take advantage of currents, perhaps. So I don't know that they know to come back, but it may be that their lifestyle is tailored around the climate, the ocean climate, in a way that they can take advantage of those kinds of situations. I mean, I've been working with a very wonderful oceanographer, a marine biologist for years, who studies larvae that eat coral. And it's a little invertebrate. And when it finds itself over the coral, it stops swimming. And the idea is that it has preferential settlement on the coral. So they may have, you know, some behavior that allows them. But this is if you... I went to Wikipedia, okay? I'm not embarrassed. I looked up larval dispersal. And they said, larval transport is one of the most interesting and significant questions that we don't understand in oceanography. So if you don't understand it, you're doing as well as almost every other oceanographer in the world. Okay. So anybody else? Yes. Okay, so the question was, how long do we think these guys can last? And I think we've actually done some of the energetics on that. It depends. If they're just at depth, we think they can last maybe a month or so. If they have to come up and talk to us, maybe it's more like a couple of weeks, because it takes energy for them to come. They have to push against the pressure and come back up. But it's clear that we won't be able to, I don't think we'll be able to, like, so that's an example. The gliders can go out for 3 months. And some of the floats, like Argo floats, can go out for a really long time. I think it works in our favor a little bit because coastal oceanography is much more energetic. And so these things are being pushed around a lot. And the reason we need lots of them is because two might start out together and they might wind out far apart. And what we're trying to learn is how far apart they might be. So I think that's a good question. But we're sort of thinking weeks to a month or something like that. There was a question in the back. Well, so when we had the undergraduates actually building the two that I showed you, it turns out that the pressure in the cylinder wouldn't allow those to go deeper. But we actually have a design in our lab, which we submitted in one of those three proposals, to build one which mechanically operates, which would allow it to go to 100 meters or even deeper than that. It's just the in principle, it's a matter of how hard you're willing to work to come back up. The going down is easy, as we all know. Coming back up is the hard part. So you inflate your buoyancy controller and you come up in a way. Yes, anyone else? Yes? So I'll repeat the question. What is the difference between what we're doing and the Argo floats? The answer is that those floats, in principle, the 3,000 Argo floats are not really tracked in real time. They don't communicate with each other. Tom Rossby has worked on floats that he puts in the SOFAR channel that are tracked in real time. And actually what's happened is the P. Alice floats that my colleague here, Russ Davis, builds, mostly what they're doing now is profiling. So they go down for a while and then they profile coming back up and coming down. And so our ability to have them, and they're also controlled, so those floats are not necessarily depth controlled. So we'd like to be able to get them to sit on an ISO bar, which is a pressure surface, an isotherm, which is a temperature, or even if we could get a salinity measurement on them, an isopycnal. And there's a lot of interest. It turns out pushing things around on ISO density surfaces is pretty easy. It doesn't take a lot of energy. You don't change your energy. And how stuff gets pushed around on isopycnals in the coastal ocean is something that we've had a lot of interest from physical oceanographers on. I haven't talked much about it here, partly because of the complexity. And these things are also this big. So it turns out being smaller is better because it puts you in a different flow regime. Now, you might argue that 3 meters and 20 centimeters or 12 centimeters isn't a huge difference, but we'd even like to make them smaller because your ratio of surface drag to inertia changes. It's a thing called Reynolds number. And so being little is tough because the water becomes much more viscous because your surface area is so huge. Compared to your volume, it's like me trying to swim. You know, I do it anyway, but it feels viscous all the time. I don't know why. So, any more questions? Okay, well, I want to thank you so much for having the opportunity, and I really appreciate your coming here, and I hope you can help me dream about next generation oceanographic systems. So thank you very, very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.